Hi, guys. All right, so I need a couple volunteers. Just like two. You can come up here if you'd like. You don't have to, but if you don't, then we need you to tell a story. So, cool. Thanks, Mariah. One more. Thanks, Don. Awesome. Do you want to grab that mic really quick? Yeah. Yes, yes. No, I said tell a story, which involves speaking, so.
Oh, I just heard volunteer.
Okay, well, thank you for volunteering. So the volunteering thing that you just signed yourself up for is can you tell us a story of a time in your past that you received a punishment?
When I was little, I was with a friend of mine, and I was five, and we were going to the park, and we ran, I had been trained, you look both ways across the street. Well, my friend had looked, and she knew no one was coming, but I just went with her and ran across the street, and so my mom was not thrilled about that, because I needed to stop and look both ways, so
gotcha.
I got punished.
What did she do?
Well, that was back in the days of spanking, so I got some homework. And I had to sit in my room and wait for the spanking. And I think we had a paddle.
Oh, that's the worst.
So there was a paddle, and I waited for the paddle. And we talked about what decision I had made. And I got a paddle. But it wasn't, I wouldn't call it abusive. I think it hurt more than it hurt me.
Gotcha. Now, if you could stay up here, I'll have one more question for you after. But Mariah, would you mind telling us your story of the time you received a punishment?
Okay. I think I was 8 years old, and my aunt was watching me one afternoon, and I had overheard a word at school one day.
Oh, no.
And the funny thing about it was in Spanish, and so, it was in Spanish, and so I decided to say that word. I didn't know what it meant, but my aunt caught me saying that word, and she said, "Don't say that word, it's a bad word in Spanish." And I was like, "Okay." And then she walked away. I said it again. I said it again, and so she had me take a spoonful of tapatio and drink that. And that is the reason why I do not like spicy food or tapatio. Or bad words as well. So
all right.
I'm scarred forever. So I'm a Mexican who does not like spicy food or tapatio.
Because of that word. All right. Nice. So the next question I have for you guys is, if you were going to write a letter about this experience to the world, what would you say? I know that's kind of a vague question, but I want to leave it as open as possible for what comes to your mind. If you were going to tell that story, I mean, you just told it. Is there a lesson that you would like to share? Is there something you learned from that experience? What would you say?
This is hard because I like to write and I write too much.
That's okay. You're gonna see that I have the same problem. I have like 9 pages of notes up here, but don't worry, some of them are scribbled out.
So part of me would probably say that was a bad idea to do that. And part of me would be like, I probably would have like, I don't know. There was some nuance too of like, I think I'd write about that, it's good to look both ways when you cross the street. So there was a very important lesson there, and the spank is much less of a punishment than getting hit by a car. Yes.
True.
So that is a good idea to reinforce that in children. I think, so there's that, and then also maybe the dialogue I had with my mom at that age, maybe we could have understood each other better.
Cool. Thank you, Dawn. Mariah, what would you say in your letter?
I think I would probably mention just to listen to your elders as much as possible and actually respect them because they're looking out for you. And then also look up the word that you don't know. Just to be safe. Just
in case.
Yeah. It's always good to have knowledge, so. Yes.
Yes, know what you're saying before you say it.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. You can have a seat if you'd like. So one time I received a punishment, not just one time, I had multiple of them. But this particular one, now I would say my parents were, they were pretty fair about our punishments. Like I'm sure I deserved all of them. I never had any moments where they were like, oh, whoops, sorry, that wasn't your fault. Most of them were like, okay, that was my fault. I got punished. They seemed pretty fair, but there was this one that I'd never really understood completely. And my mom even told me later, she's like, yeah, I don't know why I made that decision. But there was this time where I threatened to run away for whatever reason I had in my small mind. And my mom's response to that was, okay, fine. We're going to prepare you for that. You get a practice version. And I was like, what? What's a practice version? I just was going to run away. Like, you can't practice for that. She goes, yep, take off all your clothes right now. And I was like, what? And she goes, take off all your clothes. You can leave your underwear on. And you go outside and you stay there. And I was like, I'm just going to run away. And she goes, no, you have to go in the backyard. You can't run away. You have to stay out there. And this is a practice to see if you can make it. And I was like, but I would bring my clothes. She goes, go outside. And I was like, all right. So I went out there in my underwear. And I just remember sitting on our porch thinking like, well, now what? Like, is she going to let me back in? Like, how long is this practice version? And I was sitting out there, got kind of hungry. She said I couldn't have any food, so started eating the dog food. That wasn't that great. And then I started thinking, I don't know how long I was out there. Honestly, I don't remember. To me, it seemed like hours. It could have been a whole 10 minutes. I don't know. But I was out there, and I do remember watching the sunset and thinking, this is going to be cold. And I remember thinking next, can I fit in the doghouse with the dog? Like, that might be a little warmer. Can I make it through the night? Like, I don't know how this is gonna go. And eventually, I realized that I didn't really want to do that very much. And so it seemed like a better plan to be humiliated and to go cry to my mom and ask her, please let me back in, instead of just sitting out there freezing with the dog in the doghouse. And so I tried that, and she said no. And so I was like, oh, darn it. I think I tried that like 3 more times, and finally she let me back in and told me to go to my room. And I don't really remember what happened after that. But I do remember there was some kind of comment of like, I hope you learned your lesson. And so I was thinking about this question that I just asked Don and Mariah about, like, what would I do if I was going to write a letter to the world about that event? And I would like to say, you know, that I learned my lesson, that, you know, it was a really good lesson that I can't do this thing alone, that I can't run away. But honestly, the real lesson that I learned back then was, I'll just do it better next time. You know, I wouldn't be so unprepared if I really ran away. I would know now, thanks to the practice version, that I have to bring food and clothes. Gosh, most of my punishments probably ended with some sort of sarcasm like that, so I don't know how my parents made it, but anyway, I didn't run away, thankfully, after that. But today we're going to learn about another story of a king who received a punishment, and he writes a letter about it. So, cheesy intro, I admit it. But this king is named Nebuchadnezzar. So if you would turn with me to Daniel 4, we can read it together. So what Nebuchadnezzar is doing in this chapter, it seems, is that He received a punishment, and he wants to tell the world about it, and he has a specific message, I think, that he's trying to share because of this punishment. And it's way better than now I know how to run away better. All right, so you guys are looking like you're pretty much there. So Daniel 4, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree. Remember, Marquita said he really likes making decrees. That all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw, in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, Chop down the tree, and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves, and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it, and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached to heaven and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, Chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High. Now God's making decrees. Which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. Now let's pause for a minute. This is pretty serious stuff. What would you do if you got a warning like this? Like, hey, King Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to go nuts because you've been prideful. You thought this was all about you. What would you do? This is a real question. Yes. She said she'd be tempted to say one of Mariah's words, if anyone didn't hear that. Yeah, you'd be pretty scared. Probably, hopefully, take it seriously, right? Well, next verse, verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't listen. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. Yeah. "At the end of the days," he's talking to us again, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?' At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble." That's a pretty good letter. So how many of you have heard this story before? Pretty much everyone. We've basically got it down, right? What's Nebuchadnezzar's problem? Pride. What happens when he doesn't listen to God's warning? He goes crazy. What happens after he goes crazy? Yes. God's the one in charge, not me. He repents, and then what happens? He's restored and blessed, even more than he was before. It's all very nice. It's almost like a fairy tale, really. And it really makes a great flannel graph presentation. I remember watching that one so many times. But even as a kid watching that, I felt like I always had questions. Here's a look into my mind again. Why was Nebuchadnezzar so happy after getting humbled? Another question. Did the whole kingdom see this guy go crazy? Or did Daniel and the others just tell everyone he went on an extended trip somewhere? I also wanted to know, did he eat grass by, like, pulling it out with his teeth, or did he pick it with his hands first and then eat it? But most of all, even as a kid, I wondered, why in the world did they let this guy be king again? And I must admit that as I read it, in preparation for this sermon, I had the same questions. I mean, the grass detail didn't matter as much anymore, but I still found myself asking, why is Nebuchadnezzar so happy after getting humbled? And why did anyone let him be king again? Because it wasn't just God that did that. It was the counselors and the lords. They sought him out. They're like, come on, come back. You get to be king again after all that. Are these guys even more crazy than Nebuchadnezzar? And so I kept reading the story over and over, and then I found that my questions were not being answered by the way I was reading it. You see, it seemed like a very clear lesson. Nebuchadnezzar is very clear why he was writing. Did you guys hear it? He said he's writing to extol the King of Heaven. He's writing so that everyone knows that God is king. He wants to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for him. Clear enough. God is also very clear in this one. He tells you exactly why Nebuchadnezzar is getting punished. And exactly how long he's going to be punished. Until he knows that the Most High rules and that he sets over the kingdoms of men whom he will. So those things look clear. But there was something about the tone of the letter that I couldn't seem to reconcile. I wanted this to be grim and serious. He was getting humbled, after all. But try as I might, his letter would not fit into my box. It was too happy. See, I was hoping that was just a leftover feeling from the yellow felt sun that my Sunday school teacher put on the flannel graph board. I've always felt it didn't fit in the story. But try as I might, despite my efforts to imagine storm clouds, Nebuchadnezzar's letter is packed through with a tone of wonder, awe, and joy. His response to this whole thing is praise, and it's joyous praise. But how? And why does he get to be king again? Then I notice this strange little verse. It's verse 19. Look at it with me. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. This verse made me stop. A little weird, huh? We've seen Daniel being a pretty amazing character in the past few weeks. But I think I found myself more in awe of this one than I did of his other stunts. You see, Daniel has compassion for this guy. Compassion, love, and a wish for prosperity and blessing for him. He wishes, genuinely, that the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had would be for his enemies, which would mean Nebuchadnezzar would continue to prosper. And this happens right after Nebuchadnezzar tells him a dream that reveals just how nasty this guy's pride is. I'm sure Daniel had seen pride in him before, but now he sees its depth and what God thinks of it. It would have been pretty easy, right, for him to take advantage of the king in this moment? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar didn't know the meaning of his dream. He didn't know he just spilled the secret of his sins out in front of Daniel. Daniel could have said, ha, that's what you get, you crazy fool. That's what you get for trying to throw my friends in the fire last chapter. That's what you get for trying to think so wrongly about your interpretation of the world. But Daniel doesn't say any of this. Instead, he's dismayed. He's bummed out. And he tells the king he genuinely wishes the dream could have been talking about the king's enemies, rather than the king himself. He's gentle, and he's honest with Nebuchadnezzar. And he's kind enough to give him some advice at the end of his interpretation. He wants Nebuchadnezzar to be king, and to stay in the blessing that he'd been given. And as I sat there, marveling at that verse, eventually a question floated into my head. Was this odd, an honest compassion, reflective of the heart of Daniel's God? Was Daniel's God the one who wanted Nebuchadnezzar to be restored? Was he the reason Nebuchadnezzar was so happy? And suddenly the whole story began to come to life at my fingertips. Yes, Daniel's compassion, Daniel's heart for well-being and redemption and blessing for Nebuchadnezzar is reflective of God's heart. And when Nebuchadnezzar realizes that, at last, he nearly explodes with joy. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was a king, and he knew that. But what he had to learn here was that he wasn't the king. He was not the one who made Babylon great. He was not the one who made himself great. He had to learn that God was king, that heaven rules. And in the process of learning that, he finds himself in awe of God's great sovereignty and also of God's ability to humble. But he also finds himself captured by another awe. This is revealed in the heartbeat of his letter, the tone that I was talking about. It's an awe of God's grace to redeem and to bless. And this is the part I wasn't getting. See, we probably all have our flinches in relationship with God. It's pretty easy to see Nebuchadnezzar's. His flinch? Pride. Obviously. It's the idea that he's pretty great, and he pretty much ignores God in the process. My flinch, and the reason I struggled with this text, is pride too. But mine looks a little bit different. Mine is the kind of the Pharisee. Mine is the sort of pride that masks itself as religious well-being. But it's really just an obsession with the details just enough to skate by without being embarrassed. To skate by without being caught. To think, oh, I can watch that guy be humbled over there. Good thing they didn't see I didn't clean the inside of my dish because I ran away just in time. My flinch in seeing God in the midst of this is to scowl at his reckless grace. Not because I don't want it, but because I forget I can trust it. And I forget that I can trust him withholding me when he blesses me again. I forget that God's heart is for blessing, for restoration, for us. And so I tend to flinch away from him, to close myself off, and to try to make it out untouched because I fear that what's coming is painful fire. And then I encounter a text like this that's different than my expectations. And then I think, well, I should have known better. Like, come on, I've read the prophets. I should have known better. I've been to this church. I should have known better. I lived with a family that practically breathed love as a rhythm. And the list that I tried to write of why I should go, I should have known better, it could go on and on, but it's ridiculous. It's endless. And I should have stopped at the first word. Should I have known better? It's not the right question. Nebuchadnezzar didn't ask that question. He just said, yeah, I did it. Daniel didn't ask that question. He just said, probably don't do that. And God doesn't seem to ask that question either. Even if he does, he doesn't need a list of reasons to go with it. He just needs a, yeah, sorry, I should have known. You don't have to say why, because his main question is, what will you do now? What will you do after you've come face to face with your weakness and sin? What will you do when your reason returns to you? What letter will you write to the world? Nebuchadnezzar blesses God. He praises God as sovereign king. And in this, we see what being humbled really looks like. Humility is not a reduction or a degradation of yourself. It's a perspective shift. To be humbled is to be taken aback by a goodness and greatness outside of you. It's to be tickled with joy that the story isn't all about you, and it gets to be about someone else. It's also an acceptance of the idea that God likes to keep giving us another chance. Humility means you've had your eyes open to a perspective that surpasses the dimness of self-focus. Our gaze becomes locked on something that's far more worth looking at. It's like the comparison of looking at a rainbow instead of a shadow in a puddle. You can keep analyzing the shadow in the puddle all day, but it's not going to be any more clear by the time you get done with it. But the rainbow allows you to stand there in awe, and you don't have to understand it to appreciate its beauty. In the words of C.S. Lewis, he said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. You've got a better focus. I thought, even when I first heard this story as a kid, that I'd find Nebuchadnezzar at the end of his story cowering in defeat. but he's not. He's standing. He's standing with his eyes turned upward, smack dab in the middle of a grace that neither our dust-ridden, miserly world nor our Pharisee souls could have ever dreamed could exist. Grace is what lets him be king again. And he's standing in that grace and simply, thankfully praising God. And in that, he's inviting us to do the same. Nebuchadnezzar's letter is a dancing, joyous encouragement to us to have our own perspective shift into a humility of joy, not of defeat. And how do we do that? Well, Nebuchadnezzar says when his reason returned to him, he lifted his eyes to heaven. So we look at God. We lift our eyes to heaven and we look at God. Specifically, we look at him as the sovereign king. We say with Nebuchadnezzar, "How great are your signs, O Lord? How mighty are your wonders? Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and your dominion endures from generation to generation." We look at him as the awe-inspiring Lord of all. And we marvel that this great king graciously redeems us. And note that we don't have to wait for punishment to jump into that. We can do it beforehand. We can invite God to become king in our lives in a new way. We can ask him to take over territory that we might have tried to bar him from in the past. And we can ask him to keep being king of what we've already given him. This is something Nebuchadnezzar found himself learning before he asked for it. But once he got a taste of what God's kingdom was like, he delighted at the idea that that kingdom wasn't ever going to end. See, God's kingdom is freeing. God's kingdom is beautiful. And God's kingdom is full of hope for our redemption. So as we wrap up, I'm going to invite you to pray with me. With Nebuchadnezzar, I invite you to ask God to be king in a new way, or maybe in the same way repeated, of your heart and life. I invite you to acknowledge his kingdom and to ask him to stroll with you into some parts of your forest that maybe you feel nervous about letting him see. Because you might find some briars in there. There might be some tangled ivy, some cobwebs, some crooked trees. But when he sees that stuff, he's not going to make you feel like slime. Because the voice that calls us slime is the voice of the enemy. Instead, he will look at us with the same compassion that Daniel had for Nebuchadnezzar. And whatever he decides to do in our story, we can be sure that it will be an outpouring of grace. It will be a move that will turn our eyes upward to him and cheer our hearts in the wonder that his kingdom is so relentlessly full of blessing. So please repeat after me. Father, we acknowledge that you are king. We acknowledge that you are a good king. And we are so grateful that your kingdom never ends.
We are so grateful that your kingdom never ends.
Father, sometimes we forget that you are king.
Father, sometimes we forget that you are king.
We try to be kings and queens on our own.
We try to be kings and queens on our own.
But we know that the territory of our heart is better with your flag on it. We know that the territory of our lives is better with your flag on it. We know that the territory of our world is better with your flag on it. And so we acknowledge you as king anew. Now this part, church, let's do together as our Lord Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who have trespassed against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory. Amen. I'd like to leave you with one more story. How many have read or watched C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Awesome. There's a young boy in that story named Edmund, who betrays his three siblings and the king of the land of Narnia because he wants to be king himself. When he is rescued from the dreadful white witch and returned back to his siblings and to Aslan, the king of Narnia, they all accept and forgive him. And he has a conversation with Aslan that no one hears, but that changes his life forever. And then moments later, the witch comes. She says, "You have a traitor there, Aslan." And of course, everyone present knew that she meant Edmund. But Edmund had got past thinking about himself after all he'd been through and after the talk he'd had that morning. He just went on looking at Aslan. It didn't seem to matter what the witch said. Edmund's siblings noticed that. After that talk with Aslan, he loses a sour look he'd had on his face ever since he started school. Later in life, he becomes known as King Edmund the Just, a man great in counsel and judgment. And I think this was because in the logic of Aslan's kingdom, he was not squashed, but enlivened. So as we go from here, may we be enlivened and encouraged, because we have the opportunity to keep inviting God to be king, to keep realizing, like Nebuchadnezzar, how joyful his kingdom is, and to keep asking that his kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. As you think of Nebuchadnezzar's letter, remember that punishment from the Lord has always behind it a heart for our redemption. And as we learn this, as we learn to stand in the grace and adjust to the freedom of our Father's kingdom, may we follow Nebuchadnezzar's example. May we write letters of testimony, declaring with our words, our songs, in the ink of our lives, what it is to know God as King. For he is, after all, a very good King.